We're all counting on you. It's only a quarter of the portfolio.
Jeez.
Right.
All right. Made the motion.
Yeah, but I did it because Jerry encouraged me.
We are now at item that six. And you enjoy a educational presentation from Barris.
Party favors.
Very nice. Yeah, I think that's one of the channels to plug our client summit.
Thank you.
Coasters or something.
Thank you.
I'm guessing this is in San Francisco. Just couldn't get any of
it. I think it is.
Park 55.
We already started talking about the administrative end of actually getting everyone to sign up and register. And with this, the registration process really requires us to have your email address to do that. We don't share it. We don't do anything with it. You won't get anything else. In 2 years, you might get an invitation to the 2019 summit. But aside from that, I don't think you'll be getting anything else from us. So hopefully that gives you some level of comfort that the registration system is something you can be comfortable in using. So, but you'll see on that we have David Brooks. I think I mentioned that last time. Cliff Asness will also be speaking. We might have one other external speaker. The agenda is getting finalized. The book that David Brooks is going to be talking about, a great read, thin read. In fact, it's The Road to Character, number one New York Times bestseller. And at the book, I thought you'd like this. A hyper-readable, lucid, often richly detailed human story. I mean, how can you not get behind that?
What compelling is that? That's
Bill O'Reilly.
He's available.
Probably cheap, too.
At a lower fee.
He's at a book signing today by himself.
We just had Billy Bush there to draw some.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. I'm here. I'm here for Tuesday.
Keep your waitress.
2.5 hours in, this is going to be a tough one.
All right. Before this goes downhill any faster, Ed.
So I wanted to introduce Glenn Kagan with me as well. So Glenn, I think, has been to prior meetings with us. Glenn is a consulting associate at Barris, works directly with me, strictly on public plan. So he's been working on your plan for the past year and knows it very well inside and out. In addition to being a consulting associate, and he comes to us from a private equity firm for a brief moment of time, and before that he was with another investment consultant. And when he was with that other investment consultant, he was actually doing quite a bit in the hedge fund space, helping to manage their fund of funds hedge fund portfolio. So a lot of detailed knowledge about specific managers, how the program was put together, and all of those good things. And because we're talking about these risk diversifying strategies, that made a lot of sense to bring him along, and he's going to be covering a portion of the presentation as well. So he earned his undergrad from USC and CFA charter holder and all of that good stuff. So, okay, great. So let's dive in. I'd like to ask you to turn behind tab one, page four, in the executive summary. So this is really an education session. So please ask questions throughout. We put together some slides we think are in a reasonable order, but certainly happy to jump around and hit whatever things we need to hit. So the first couple of bullet points, I think, outline what we already know about 9% allocation to risk diversifying strategies in the asset allocation, following the functionally focused portfolio concept construct. And so this presentation, third bullet point, is designed to provide education on risk parity and what that is, an overview of risk diversifying strategies and the spectrum of those strategies, and then get into various ways of implementing them. And so implementation is a key determinant here as well that we'll need to be thinking about down the road. No formal recommendations at this time. I will caution you that there is some jargon once we start getting into risk diversifying strategies, words like carry, instead of using the normal word return, hedge fund world likes to use carry, meaning that while we're invested in the strategy, we're getting a carry or we're getting a return. Some strategies have a negative carry and weird things like that, so that's some jargon. Shorting, we don't talk a lot about shorting in our other strategies. Here we'll be talking about shorting, and that essentially means that we see a security that's overvalued, and what we'll do, or what these managers do, is they borrow that security from someone else, they sell it with the expectation that's going to go down in price, buy it back in the future, and then give it back to whoever they borrowed it from. Kind of a complex working, but that's an effective way of saying I think it's overpriced, I'm going to take advantage of that, and when it becomes lower priced, I'm going to capitalize on that change in price. Hedge, the word hedge in and of itself is an academic term where we talk about reducing risk, that we can do something to hedge our portfolio. That just means reduce risk. So they start throwing around all this stuff, and it becomes really commonplace, and all of a sudden you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so if it ever gets to that point, let's hit the brakes and make sure that we're all on the same page. Plenty of other jargon will be thrown around in these things too. On page 5, we outline what we're trying to do with this portion of the portfolio, risk diversifying strategies. It's these three bullet points. It's low to negative correlation to the growth portfolio. So as the growth portfolio does what we expect it to do, it also has volatility to it. And so it's really subject to market drawdowns or corrections in the market. And we want this portion of the portfolio to benefit in those times, to actually go up in value. And when it goes up in value with our growth portfolio going down, that's the low to negative correlation, meaning that these two things, their returns, don't behave in the same manner, and maybe even in a negative way, so that when growth is going down, the risk diversifying is going up. That would be a nice benefit, and that's what we're trying to capture here. Second point, positive expected return. Again, positive carry. And the third bullet point, high degree of liquidity. And so we were just talking about the private markets and appropriately pointing out that these private markets are illiquid. Well, we're doing that with intent because we know we want that in the portfolio. On this side of the portfolio, we want liquidity. And so when those markets do correct, we want to be able to sell out of these strategies and take advantage of low-priced growth securities and invest in those. And so then conceptually, we have these Harvey Ball diagrams, these kind of pie charts filled in an odd way, Harvey Balls. And so here we're showing the three components to the investment program. We have the growth portfolio. We expect that to benefit from GDP growth in a big way. That's why that circle is colored in completely, so the solid green. Earn a risk premium. There's some risk there, and we expect to capture it. Produce some stable income, not as important. Hedge against inflation, partially. And then the three boxes to the right on diversification and volatility. Low absolute volatility? No. Our growth portfolio is going to have high volatility. Low correlation to other assets? Not so much. And reduced portfolio volatility? Not so much. And so because that's what our growth portfolio looks like, and we have a good 60-some percent of the portfolio allocated there, we need to be thinking about this risk diversifying row at the bottom. And here, you can see that it doesn't do much on the return rolls on the left-hand side, maybe a little bit on earning return risk premium. But on the right-hand side is where it really works in spade, or hopefully, low absolute volatility, low correlation, reducing the overall portfolio volatility. Okay, so to do this, when we started modeling the asset allocation, we said, okay, 9% is our number, and we even break that apart into two allocations. One is to risk parity, and that's a 5% allocation. The other part is a 4% allocation to hedge funds of funds. It's a broad measure of hedge fund exposure. When we actually get to the implementation, we would be looking at a more nuanced approach and hopefully one that's more customized to the needs of our portfolio. But for modeling purposes, we just use that kind of blunt instrument. This risk parity is the next part. Risk parity can be confusing. I think it's probably the worst naming, worst marketing out there, is that risk parity. Well, you put together two words that make no sense to me now. And so what does this mean? So let's take a step back, and before we get into the pages and what they all say, conceptually, what is this thing designed to do? It's a portfolio of investments that tries to get equal risk. That's the parity part of it. It tries to get equal risk from your stocks and from your bonds and from real assets. That way, it benefits partially from the growth in the economy. It plays defense the way your bonds would be expected to. And it benefits from growth in real assets, like TIPS or commodities, things that are inflation protected. So it has an equal weighting there. If you think through when we do our asset allocation work with you, we put together a bunch of portfolio mixes and show them to you on a risk return trade-off graph. And you look at these different things and you say, okay, I can be here. This is how much risk I think we can take, and this is how much return we get. This portfolio says, I want to dial that back. In fact, I want to get a lot more volatility from my fixed income portfolio. And so I really want to ramp up my fixed income exposure, because fixed income exposure has some really interesting characteristics, like in a market drawdown. It doesn't take a lot for the equity markets to correct a little bit before my whole entire portfolio is down significantly. And even though my bond portfolio has increased a little bit, it doesn't offset the loss that I had in equities. Risk parity says, okay, then if that's the case, give me a whole lot more fixed income. So whenever the markets do correct and the equity markets pull back, my fixed income rises proportionately. And therefore, I've mitigated the risk in my portfolio. That's why it's risk parity. Does that make sense? Okay, good. I'm seeing some nods.
Sounds like you're hedging there.
Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. Yep. You're hedging out a lot of the equity risk. Yeah. Okay. So on page 7, we show a couple key points. The top line is that this is a long-only portfolio, that they generally invest in stocks, bonds, and commodities or tips and what have you in a long-only position. We're buying them long. We're just like we do in the rest of our portfolio. We buy it to own it for some period of time, and when it fulfills its position, then we get out of it. The three bullet points below that are what they invest in, the global equities, and it is global. It's not just U.S. Global equities, global fixed income, commodities, and global inflation-linked bonds. So like U.S. TIPS, Treasury, inflation-protected securities, the U.S. Other countries offer those same kinds of securities, and so it is global there. And then the last bullet point ends with the expected level of risk. These strategies look at their portfolios and they say, if we combine them in the right way, they're quantitative strategies, if we combine these in the right way, our models tell us that we should get about a 10% volatility or a 12% volatility or 15, whatever the number is. They create different portfolios around it, but they set it with that volatility expectation rather than a return target. And so they say, okay, if I get a 10% volatility based on what we're seeing in the markets, that should generate a positive return of X. If we say a 12% volatility, that should give us a higher return. So they do have up and down movement, depending on how much we want, 10%, 12, 15, whatever. And that's how they work. And that way, throughout the business cycle, throughout the market cycles, regardless of what's going on, they deliver a consistent volatility result to us, and the returns come out of that. So a different concept, but because of that approach, when we add it into a portfolio that has the wild volatility that we have, then it has offsetting trade-offs, offsetting characteristics, and that's part of the benefit. So when we think about the desirability of this, it has a low correlation. It has a positive return, and they tend to be very liquid strategies. So that's why we're bringing it to you. On page 8, there are a couple things worth calling out on this slide. We have at the top the traditional approach to portfolio construction. It's basically what we do. We look at the volatilities and correlations and returns of all the asset classes, put them together in the best way that we can, and create a portfolio. With risk parity, they can do a couple things that we can't do. One is that they can take on leverage. And the leverage that they take on is implicit. The implicit part of it means that what we're going to invest in here are futures. So let's think first about stocks. When we want to buy stocks and when they buy stocks, they go out and they purchase stocks, and then that becomes part of the portfolio. When they want to take a position in commodities, they can't really take a position. They don't really want to buy the commodities. They don't have the storage capabilities to store barrels of oil and train car loads of corn or soybeans or what have you. So they get into the futures market, which is a futures contract that says we have the ownership right to buy oil in 3 months or 9 months or 12 months, whatever the time frame is. We're never actually going to take delivery, though. We don't actually want to put our money out and have that delivered to us. So we're going to buy a futures contract, and as that contract comes nearer to expiration, right before delivery, we're going to settle that contract. We'll recognize a gain or a loss on that contract and then enter a new one. And that way, through the futures market, we always have exposure to the commodity. We never have to actually take delivery of the commodity. That's what they do here. That's a normal functioning market in the commodities business. That's what corn and cotton producers have been doing for hundreds of years, one of the oldest markets in the U.S. So that's what they're doing there. On the bond side, it's kind of the same as commodities. Because they want to get a lot of bond exposure, they do it through the futures market. So you can get futures on U.S. treasuries. And that way, instead of saying, I want to go out and buy $100,000 worth of bonds, you can get the same economic exposure by buying a $100,000 futures contract. In doing so, you only have to put forth $2,000 or $3,000 for that futures contract. And that way, you have $98,000 in reserve. So we take out, we get the futures contract, and then we wait for it to come near settlement. We never actually have to settle it. We just roll into a new futures contract. Now, if I buy the futures contract for $2,000 and it gives me $100,000 of notional exposure, I have $98,000 remaining. I need to manage that collateral. I need to put that somewhere safe, typically in like a short-term investment fund or a money market type fund, very highly liquid short-term bond securities. So it's like cash. I can also take a portion of that $98,000 and say, you know what? I can buy another $100,000 contract on U.S. Treasuries. It's only going to cost me another $2,000. So now I have $4,000 that I've invested in the futures. It's given me $200,000 of Treasuries exposure, and I have $96,000 of collateral. That's how they get the leverage, because when we give them a dollar, they allocate it a portion to equities, a portion to commodities, and a portion to futures and the bonds. And that bonds exposure is actually ramped up so that we get more than the dollar worth of notional exposure. Let me pause there and see if that all makes sense, because it's different. And so,
at what point does it become a crapshoot? If you keep going two more, at some point, obviously taking it all the way to the end, you've got 50 futures contracts at $100,000 each, and if you win big.
Right. So, great question, because that's exactly right. You could then just take the entire $100,000 and put it in futures, then be overexposed. If those futures experience a loss, then you owe a lot of money that suddenly you don't have the collateral to pay for. So what these managers do is they put caps on their strategies, and they say, our notional exposure cannot exceed X. X is usually something like 250% or 300%. So at most they would get 3X exposure. The idea there is then, okay, so if I take the $2,000 and buy that futures contract and I do that two more times, now I have $6,000 in futures. It gives me $300,000 of notional exposure, and I have $94,000 of collateral. That's a pretty safe position, we believe, because what would have to happen is, again, those are U.S. Treasury securities. They would have to collapse in value such that my $96,000 is not sufficient to meet that. Hasn't ever happened to U.S. government. So that's the situation where it would actually go to be a problem. So implicit leverage, if it was against stocks, we'd be, whoa, that's risky. Let's think about that. Commodities, let's make sure that's being managed smartly. But when it's against the treasuries, okay, I get it. That's why they need to do it.
I'm having trouble in at least one part of the concept here. If we buy a futures contract for $2,000 and we get to the end of the time frame for the contract and it has a value of $1,500, don't we just sell it back? Sell it on the market for the $1,500 and book a $500 loss? Why is there any claim against the assets that we didn't spend?
Well, that $500 loss would be recognized in a mark-to-market process,
right,
that would take some of those reserves to mark that. So that $500 would be what we'd have to pay up.
All right, so that's what we're talking about as a loss. As a charge, it would be the loss on the contract. And if we have one contract against 100,000 in assets, 98 of which went into something very safe, so presumably we got the 98 plus some return,
right,
on the 98, but we lost 500 on the contract.
Right.
Okay, all of that gets netted.
That's right.
And our net loss is still a pretty small number.
That's right.
Okay, I just make sure I understood.
Yep, you're right on. Okay. Right on point.
So a lot of people gone broke playing the futures market. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's touch on that a little bit, because the way the funds are set up, we don't have any obligation beyond what we commit to it. So if we say to a risk parity manager that we're going to invest $1 million in it, that $1 million is all that we are exposed to. So even though that we're talking about futures positions, those futures do not come back to us. It's only the $1 million that we commit to that. And that's true of the strategy. So the way they manage that process, each one's a little bit different in terms of the management and how they handle that risk. But that is the maximum loss potential, period. So even though it's futures of how they're using it, they're not using it to the full extent. The loss, so people going broke in playing the futures market, is when they do the overextension, where they think they're getting economic exposure to something and they have a really strong opinion about it, but they end up being wrong. Then the collateral, or the call to them, the mark to market, is greater than what they have in reserve capital, and they go broke.
Especially when they bought on margin.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Can you just touch on the duration? They
range. So it depends on the manager and the implementation.
But generally, we're talking shorter terms so that we can do course corrections.
Oh, yeah. 3, 6, 9 month kind of, yeah.
So these might be 1.5, 1.5 type duration, not 6, 7, 8 type duration numbers?
Well, so I think Tim was asking about the duration of the contract. Will be of those 3, 6, 9 month kind of ilk. The treasuries underlying them will often be longer term treasuries, so they might be 7 or 10 year treasuries. So I guess I want to be careful about how I answer the duration question in the fixed income space.
Okay, thanks.
So if the market starts moving against the manager or not coming through, some either they're uncomfortable or it's a violation of the thesis, the futures contract is only for a relatively limited period of time. That can roll down, it can actually be sold before completion, or it can roll down and you do a course correction for the next contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so on page 8, the middle section, risk parity, does two key things, uses leverage, okay, so we discussed that, weights the asset class exposures so that asset class contributes an equal amount of expected volatility to the portfolio. That second bullet point is the second key point I want to make here, so good, it works on the presentation. The idea here is that they are doing the modeling very similar to what we do with you. When we do an annual asset class review, we bring forth our capital market assumptions that say, here are our risk return correlation expectations for a 10-year time frame. They're doing that same kind of analysis, but on a daily basis. And so they don't necessarily adjust the portfolio on a daily basis, typically less frequent, more like a monthly adjustment, the way the contracts work and such. But they're looking at that more dynamically than we can. And that's interesting because as we're sitting here today in our governance model, you can see that we wouldn't be able to make those kinds of decisions every month. They can do that. And so by bringing it into the portfolio and giving it the allocation that we're doing, that adds something to our process because they're dynamically looking at the volatility in the markets and adjusting for it. And so that's something unique that you see here. You don't see that with other strategies. Okay. Next couple of pages show some interesting charts. Page 9 is actually something you've seen before in our asset allocation studies and something that many of these managers used, which just points out that when you allocate a portfolio 55% equity, 35% to fixed income, 10% to real assets, what we kind of generically call a 60-40 portfolio, you actually get a lot more equity risk exposure than what you might think, which is what's on the right-hand side, 85%. So risk parity accomplishes that differently. Here we're showing a sample slide of one asset allocation where they allocate 44% to equity, 40% to real assets, 166% to fixed income. So this particular strategy has an allowable 250% of notional. And the risk allocation then comes out 40% with that much higher component to fixed income risk. Page 11 touches on leverage, which I think we've hit pretty hard already. And then just a couple points on page 12. Here we're showing what happens when we add risk parity to a portfolio. So we take just a typical peer and we say, okay, what if you added 5, 10, and 20% allocation while proportionately adjusting all of the other allocations in that portfolio? And you can see that the Sharpe ratio improves, the median expected return improves, the drawdown correction improves. So this has a bit to do with our CMAs, how we model risk parity, and it looks favorable. And so when we look at our CMAs, we beat that up and say, wait a minute, if we have something that really looks favorable, then that's naturally going to guide the model to do a heavier allocation to it because it helps the portfolio. Do we really believe that? And so we were beating it up saying, okay, it's tough to model risk parity in and of itself because of everything that's going on there. Let's take a look at the historical results and see if that makes sense. And indeed, the historical results are better than what we model, so that's good. We're being conservative in that respect. The other way is we took a look at a 60-40 portfolio and said, what if we were able to do a 60-40 portfolio in kind of an unconstrained way, where we could just go after the most favorable securities, be it stocks, bonds, all sectors, all exposures, what have you. And that turned out to come out to a very similar result as our risk parity assumption. And we said, oh, that's interesting, because now we have, on the high side, the historical results are favorable. On the other side, even if we had an unconstrained portfolio, we could do it. So having a risk parity capital markets assumptions seem reasonable based on what we're seeing here. So yes, they're favorable, but not grandiose by any means. We should also talk a little bit about when risk parity underperforms. I'm certainly not trying to sell a silver bullet here by any means. Risk parity is going to have trouble when rates go up significantly because its exposure to fixed income is high. So if everything else was equal in the world and the 10-year rate went from 2.3% that we're at today to 3.3%, we would expect risk parity to underperform. We also see it lag in strong up markets, strong equity bull markets. And so I guess that's not surprising. We're telling you that we want something that has low correlation to the growth portion of our portfolio. And so indeed, when the equity markets are rallying, this has a heavy weight to fixed income. It's not going to capture as much of that. It has some exposure to equity, but it's not going to capture all of it. The third point is with regards to commodities. It does have commodities exposure. Most of them have commodities exposures. And so when we saw oil correct, 2015 now, they underperformed them because they had some pretty significant exposure. And it wasn't just oil. It was all the commodities working in tandem at that same time. So 2015 was a difficult year. 2016 was a great year because all those things reversed. Commodities found solid footing, rates came down, and equities did well. And so it was kind of perfect storm. Everything worked well in it. Doesn't always happen. Interestingly, when the new administration was elected into office, we saw equity markets rally. We saw rates increase, so sell-off in the bond market, and commodities moved along. And we were really curious, how would the risk parity managers manage that? And they did pretty well. So they backed off. Their models told them to back off on the fixed income exposure, so they lightened that, and they increased the equity exposure. And so they ended up doing pretty well in that scenario. So it's always interesting to see, you know, just real-world cases and see what happens. And then the last thing is that ultimately we want to know from you if we should continue with this, if this makes sense and something we should be considering, whether we should continue modeling it as we bring back the next asset allocation for you in May.
Yes, sir. A quick question. So if you're trying to maintain the same level of risk in time and you do get a rally in equities, does that then imply that there's less risk? I mean, they increased their equity exposure. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that they built, well, there's less risk in equities now because the momentum is going up, so we'll go ahead and increase our exposure there to maintain return or...
Yeah. So their version of risk is volatility. And so when it's directional, volatility can come down, and that will... It depends on the trade-offs and where they're at in the portfolio. So they may well increase it because the volatility has come down and they need to get more exposure to that volatility to reach their volatility target. But it's kind of hard to say because it is the volatility, and so the directionality is one component.
So if equities are shooting up and the VIX is remaining relatively stable, then
they're probably
feel
staying
more comfortable
stable.
With
Yeah, they're probably not needing to change. If you see VIX spike up, they'll probably dial back the equity.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So the next piece then is risk diversifying, turning to hedge funds. So if we turn to page 14, we really want to demystify and more accurately discuss hedge funds. And so Appendix 2 has our annual hedge fund environment in it. We're not going to get into that today, but it's a handy reference piece, and much of this content is based on it, so a lot of it is summarized. But the hedge fund moniker is really a bad moniker. For one thing, a lot of them do not hedge. The very premise of saying it's a hedge fund that's going to reduce risk, like we said what hedging is, a lot of them don't do that. The other thing is the hedge fund industry for a long time had been promising things along the lines of equity-like returns with bond-like volatility, kind of best of both worlds. And 10 years later, we see that that's a bit of a fallacy. The numbers just don't add up. And so we look at that and say, and that's why you're seeing, you know, CalPERS get out of it, and a lot of industry jargon about hedge funds being taboo. And what we have here on page 14 is, again, a set of Harvey balls, but this top section, return enhancing, this is largely that group of strategies that we're seeking to do that, seeking to generate equity-like returns with bond-like volatility. What we're talking about, again, are the diversifying kinds of strategies and what they can do here. So we're going to walk through them one by one, hitting some of the key points with them. And so I'm going to turn it over to Glenn and let him start walking us through that.
All right, so looking at the Harvey Ball chart on page 14, you'll see across the top, we are assessing each strategy along the criteria of the risk diversifying portfolio. So we're judging them of how much diversification benefit do they add to the portfolio. What's the liquidity profile of them? So in the case of a market sell-off, could we sell out of these investments and buy growth assets? And the third criteria is expected return. So utilizing Tim's unicorn analogy, the ideal strategy would have fully shaded black Harvey balls all across the way. But given the trade-offs of the different strategies, we need to determine what is the optimal mix of diversification, liquidity, and expected return. So we're really going to focus today on the strategies in the black box. So the diversified core segment of risk diversifying strategies provide broad exposure to hedge fund strategies, often in a way that combines multiple sub-strategies. So the goal here is to produce consistent risk-adjusted returns across market environments. So producing positive returns regardless of whether equity markets are up or equity markets are down. So diversified core, that includes multi-strategy hedge funds and alternative beta, which we'll get into a little bit more detail in a little bit. Underneath the diversified core, we have risk diversifying strategies, which are generally less directional than the return enhancing strategies and the diversified core. But what this leads to is lower expected returns because they have less directionality to them. But what they do provide is a diversification benefit because of its uncorrelated nature. And generally, these strategies have a bit higher liquidity profile. So within the risk diversifying bucket, we have equity hedge, market neutral, which means that for every $100 of long exposure you have, you also have $100 of short exposure. So you're not exposed directionally to the market, you're neutral. Relative value is similar, where you are basically long a security and short a security, trying to capture the spread between them. So you don't really care if equity markets go up or down or the commodity markets go up or down. You're trying to be long what you think is undervalued and short what you believe is overvalued.
It's kind of like what a bookie does, right? Try to equalize the amount of money on either side of the bet and make it on the big, right?
Right, because that's how they win in all environments, right?
Well, that's what that sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess it's not quite as pure as that. It might be something like you have an opinion of Pepsi's going to do well and Coke's not going to do well. Same space, same really close competitors, but the stocks, you decide that you're going to go long one and short the other, and net, it's neutral to the soda beverage space, I guess.
So you don't care if the beverage space goes up or down, you just care about the relation between the two.
You can be wrong, though, because they could move in the opposite direction. Then you're.
So there are risks.
Than the guy who did New Coke.
Yeah. Right.
So bringing your attention to the bottom of the black box, the macro strategies, these are tend to be diversified across equities, rates, currencies, commodities, And essentially, these are betting on different commodities or currencies or stocks. One of them, the systematic method, is more based on a quantitative model, whereas the discretionary model is a little bit more based on research and outlook on markets. And these bottom two, what they really do is they provide really strong diversification. They tend to outperform in periods of market stress. Like in 08, these strategies fared very well. They're also highly liquid because of the types of securities they're trading in, so that checks the box. But the downside is that the expected return is not quite as positive as the other strategies. So while the Harvey Ball chart has just a quarter of it shaded in, these will generally have positive carry still, just not quite as high as the directional strategies. So thinking about risk diversifying strategies, there's a number of unique considerations that Contra Costa does not necessarily currently have within the portfolio. So we've talked about leverage a little bit within the context of risk parity, but we want to touch on it real quick in the context of risk diversifying strategies here. So we talked about explicit leverage. So this is where the fund borrows against their balance sheet in order to buy additional securities. So this is explicit leverage. And we can measure this by the gross market value of securities owned to the net asset value. So if we own 150% of our net asset value, we have 50% more exposure than we would if we were not levered. On the implicit side, this is economic leverage, where there is no borrowing, and it's generally attained by investing in options, swaps, futures, things like that. And we discuss this in terms of notional exposure to net asset value. But it's important to note that implicit leverage does not imply borrowing against the fund's balance sheet. So when you're evaluating hedge fund strategies, it's really important to understand the sources of leverage, how they're getting it, whether they're doing it implicitly or explicitly, and what a reasonable level of leverage is given the fund strategy. So we'll dive into that a little bit more in the strategy specifics. Moving on to page 16, liquidity. So unlike private equity investments where you are in a locked up vehicle for a period of 5-10 years where you can't sell out of it necessarily, hedge funds are a little bit different where once you commit your money, there's generally an initial lockup period where you can't withdraw your money, say, for 6 months or a year. But once that expires, you have the ability to withdraw your money from the fund with prior notice. It's really important that managers with these types of strategies match the duration of their assets to the duration of their liabilities. So if a portfolio has a lot of illiquid assets, but 50% of their investors can redeem their money next quarter, if everybody tries to redeem, it's essentially like a run on the bank. And the remaining investors who are not redeeming are basically left with the most illiquid securities. So when you're underwriting these strategies, it's really, really important to make sure that there's a match between the assets and the liabilities so that there aren't problems. Similar, in 2008, there were some funds that ran into this problem where investors wanted their money back. The securities that they were invested in were not liquid enough to liquidate. So what happened is there's these methods for managing liquidity risk. So some managers impose redemption gates where they put a limit on how much investors could redeem at any one period, or they even suspended redemptions entirely, said you can't take your money out until markets kind of simmer down a little bit. And there's some other ways that managers deal with it. So you really want to make sure that managers have a good understanding of how they manage liquidity of their underlying investors. Moving on to page 17, shorting, as Ed touched on, a big component of these strategies is the ability to not only invest long, but also to go short as well. There's a few different types of shorting that managers employ. The first type is an alpha short, which is what Ed touched on before, which is where you think a security or a commodity or a bond is overvalued. So you sell it short, hoping that the price is going to go down so that you can realize that value. However, there's another type of shorting which is used to hedge, where you short a broad market index. So if you are long a basket of stocks, but you want to strip out your equity market risk, you can own some stocks and then short the S&P, for instance. So what you're doing there is you're stripping out some implicit equity exposure in your investment, hoping that the value of the stocks that you chose are going to outperform the broad market. So that takes down your directionality and reduces risk. The third type of shorting is pair trades, which we discussed in terms of relative value. So long Home Depot, short Lowe's, long Coke, short Pepsi, long soybean oil, short soybean meal, things like that, where you have a view that one asset is overvalued, one is undervalued, and you're trying to capture that spread. Certain strategies will employ shorting more than others. So long short equity, long short credit, macro-related strategies really require managers to be good short sellers. And that's a skill that's very difficult to be good at. And something that's very important in selecting managers is really understanding not only how good are they on the long side, but also how good are they at shorting.
Well, and I was just going to comment that with some hard learning experience of my own, figuring out...
You've got a lot of sad stories. I'm
sharing lots of...
We'll pass the plate later on.
Well, thank you.
Poor Tom.
The determining that the stock may go down at some future date, not nearly as hard as when.
Exactly.
That's the hard part, at least that became my experience. And normally you've got some covering bid in there as well. At some point, you're not going to continue to watch your short go up.
Yep.
You're going to cover the short and take your loss, and it goes up beyond your cover point.
Yep.
Before it drops back down to where you expected it to go to begin with. To me, that's been incredibly...
That's called a squeeze, right?
Illuminating and hard to do.
Yeah.
Now, are there entities out there that you found can really do that consistently?
Yeah, so I would say that there are managers out there that are very good at shorting, and that's what earns them their high fees, is their ability to be good on both sides. Given the positive expected return associated with equities, it's a lot harder to pick the equities that are going to go down. So understanding a manager's track record in shorting is really important when you're performing due diligence. It's also important to understand the manager's understanding of the shorting environment. So you don't want to be in a crowded trade on the short side, because like what you were describing, if there's a short squeeze, everybody's going to be running to cover that short. So really understanding the dynamics, making sure that you're not short a stock, that everyone else is short, and then all of a sudden they come out with good earnings and boom, the thing is going to the moon. So it's definitely an important consideration, something that has to be diligenced really well. But there are managers out there that do it well. And I think it's really important to note also that shorting is also a hedging tool. It's not just a tool to capture alpha. It's also used to mitigate and offset some risk on the long side. So there's place in the portfolio, in a lot of hedge fund portfolios for shorting that aren't just betting on a stock going down. So
one other quick comment. For those of you who haven't gotten involved in it,
this is not your Enron story.
Happily, I don't have that story. But you pay $10 for a stock, and the stock goes to zero. The maximum you can lose is $10. You short that $10 stock; it can go to 100, and you just lost 90. The short side is unlimited on losses unless you cover. Which makes it far more risky, at least in my direct experience, than the long side. So I just automatically have a discomfort with too much shorting.
Yeah.
And so you're exactly right. And being that this is the education session, we're hoping to highlight and raise the consciousness level of these things when it gets to an underwriting time. So if we were to proceed with any of this, you're asking exactly the right questions. How do I know you're not going to get yourself into that situation? And, to Glenn's point, there are some managers who are good at it. Okay, that's great. Part of the question also is, when you short that stock at $10, what do you do with the proceeds? Do you then invest it in something else which could work against you at the same time that you then owe more? Or do you choose to express your view that that stock is going to go down? You can do it in a number of ways. You could buy a put option on that stock and limit your downside if the stock continues to run up, but capture that downside if it does go down within the maturity time of that option. So lots of complexities there. So that you're asking exactly the right questions. We would caution against the shorting. What we'll hear from managers is, the basic concept is, so look, if you're hiring the best managers to go out there and buy stocks for you, and you have all these positions in your portfolio, they're doing the research and they come across these names and they're allowed to invest in everything that looks good. at the same time, don't you think they're looking and seeing a lot of things that look bad, but they can't do anything with it? If you let them buy those bad stocks, or short those bad stocks, they can get the best of both worlds. Buy the ones that are going to go up and sell the ones that are going to go down, and you have the great minds doing that. Sounds enticing. Well, let's be careful about how you actually do it and make sure there are guardrails in place.
Yeah, and one more thing I want to just highlight is that we're discussing it in terms of stocks right now, but we want to make sure that this is framed in the context of the risk diversifying portfolio. So this applies to commodities, to rates, to bonds, the things that can help offset some of the factors that are in the growth portfolio as well. So it's not just stocks. It's kind of the full gamut of potential investments here. All right, so moving on to page 18. I think you guys have seen this chart before, but this is essentially a map of the broad spectrum of risk diversifying strategies. And we ran an analysis to figure out the beta of these strategies, or the sensitivity of these strategies to the growth portfolio, specifically to contra costas asset allocation, with the purpose of really understanding how can we offset some of the risks in the growth portfolio. So if you look along the x-axis here, the beta to the growth portfolio, kind of a demarcation line we want to highlight is about around 0.5. So anything to the left of 0.5 are things that can potentially offset some of the risks in the growth portfolio, whereas the things to the right of the 0.5 have a pretty high sensitivity to the growth portfolio. So as the growth portfolio goes up, those strategies will go up, and vice versa on the downside. So we really are focusing our attention on the left side. So you'll see on the left side, this includes strategies like risk parity, like CTAs and managed futures, like market neutral equity, which we'll dive into shortly. But this just kind of gives a nice mapping of the potential universe of strategies that are out there and how they have responded historically to the contra costa growth portfolio. So that's important to note. So before I move on, I wanted to see if there's any questions before I jump into the strategy specific slides. All right. So on page 19 is our first specific strategy here. This is multi-strategy strategies. And like their name implies, these are funds that are comprised of multiple sub-strategies. So whether that's a fund that invests both in long-short equity and credit, or they have different sleeves segmented out to different teams managing merger arbitrage strategies, relative value strategies, long-short equity, these generally tend to be larger hedge funds that have specialized teams that manage sleeves that basically give you broad diversified hedge fund exposure. So the expectation with these multi-strategy funds is that you're going to generate a positive absolute return in most market environments. So across a full cycle, your return is expected to be positive. Given the diversification of the underlying strategies, as well as the number of individual securities within each sleeve, this often results in a highly diversified portfolio with relatively low volatility. Leverage is often low in these strategies, and it's important to note that there is some decent market equity market sensitivity within these strategies. So even if they're investing in credit and equities and merger arbitrage, there tends to be some sensitivity to equity markets. And just looking down below at the performance and the risk over the last 5 years, you'll see that depending on the type of multi-strategy fund, they have underperformed equities over the last 5 years while outperforming bonds with volatility levels that are pretty much in between stocks and bonds. So this is more of what you traditionally think of as a hedge fund. In terms of the liquidity, the spectrum really ranges. Some managers can invest in less liquid securities within a multi-strategy fund, including distressed credit, even private equity, emerging market securities. So liquidity may not be great in some strategies within the multi-strategy complex. And in terms of the fees, fees generally are the standard. We call it 2 and 20, but often it's more like 1.5% management fee and 20% of profits. But 2 and 20 is a bit of jargon. So, any questions on multi-strategy funds?
There's no test on this later, right? I just want to be sure.
All right. So on page 21, we have our alternative beta. So these strategies are newer in the world a bit, these tend to be strategies that systematically attempt to replicate common hedge fund styles and factors. So essentially what these are, is these are portfolios comprised of stocks, bonds, anything that can get you exposure to common hedge fund styles. So the way that they are assembled can really run a wide range of different types of portfolios, but it's really important to note that they have positive absolute returns that will emulate a diversified hedge fund portfolio. So these are essentially, is there anything you want to add on alternative beta?
I kind of think of it as like the index solution to hedge funds, where hedge funds don't have a passive option for them. But there are some managers who out there who have looked at the hedge fund space and said, wait a minute, if I take my computer models and apply it to what I'm seeing the hedge funds behave like, I think I can get those exposures for a whole lot less than 2 and 20. And I don't need to go through all of these hoops that hedge funds do. So why don't I create a portfolio that does that? And so there have been some managers that do it, and they call themselves alt beta. Instead of using the hedge fund vehicle to get that market exposure or beta, they're saying we can just create that with our own computer models and invest in publicly traded securities and create the same kind of thing for you.
But if I did an S&P index fund, I did better than all that, right?
Well, it's a risk-return trade-off. So
I was just looking at the last 5 years of performance.
Oh, yeah. The last 5 years have been fantastic for the equity market.
I know, it's been a bull run, I know, right. Yes.
So I think one interesting point here is there's not a huge number of good managers in this space. So Verus maintains a focus list of strategies that we've underwritten. So if you look at the performance here, there are some indexes that attempt to capture the broad alternative beta space. And you'll notice that there's pretty wide disparity between the managers that are on our focus list versus the indexes. So there's really not a huge universe of good managers in this space. And as I mentioned before, these our portfolios are generally highly diversified across asset classes, across markets, across strategies, and generally liquidity is pretty good in these strategies because they are investing in some of the most liquid securities markets.
Are these returns net of fees? I forgot to ask that earlier.
So these are index returns. So the indexes themselves are net of fees.
So on the prior page, on page 21, where you looked at the last 5 years of performance, and you see these alternative strategies, and then you got the S&P. In each of the other strategies, though, are those shown returns net of fees?
But I will caution you that hedge fund indexes are composites of numerous strategies. And within those composites, there is still a wide range of different strategies. So it's not as homogeneous as looking at a composite of core fixed income strategies. So there's a wide range of components to these indexes. All right, so moving on to slide 23. Relative value, structured, and sovereign. So we discussed relative value briefly, but these are pairing long trades with short trades across global rates and asset-backed securities based on fundamentals and technicals. So basically, you're taking a view on rates in Italy versus rates in France, or bonds in the U.S. versus bonds in the U.K. So basically, you're taking a long view on certain bonds and a short view on other bonds. And the idea here is that you're trying to, again, capture both sides of the trade. These strategies generally do have a positive carry, given the fact they are investing in bonds. So you are getting some cash flow while you wait. But there is generally little to no duration. So because you're pairing a long bond with a short bond, it really kind of hedges out the duration exposure within the strategy.
Or shorting of a long bond.
All right. So risk, absolute volatility may appear low because of the volatility associated with these instruments is generally low. However, because volatility is low, managers often apply a significant amount of leverage in order to increase potential expected returns. So that's a consideration with these types of strategies. Some are more directional in nature, while others really focus on being more market neutral. And as you'll see back on page 23 on the performance slide, you'll see the blue bar, the HFRI asset-backed, that's pretty strong performance over the last 5 years. And this strategy specifically was a very popular trade coming out of the financial crisis, buying structured credit that was distressed after the financial crisis. So I would caution against expecting this type of performance in periods going forward. These strategies, fees are generally standard 2 and 20, given the complexity of the markets traded, the breadth of securities used, and the types of research and the types of knowledge that's required in order to employ these strategies. All right, moving on to page 25, quantitative, equity market neutral, and systematic macro. So we can break these into two parts, the equity market neutral first. Are equity portfolios that are generally quantitatively assembled, that have generally equal exposure to long positions and short positions, with the idea that your exposure to the equity market in general is basically zero. So as markets move up or down, you really don't care because you have equal exposure on both sides of the market. So what they really rely on is persistence of trends. Systematic macro. So strategies will differ based on time horizon, the markets traded, and the research, but returns have generally come in markets where investors are behaving normally. And there tends to be a pretty big variation in style, whether it's a fund focused on a specific sector, a specific region. The idea here is that you're pairing a long portfolio with a short portfolio. And on the systematic macro side, this is applying the same type of methodology, but instead of just stocks, it's stocks, it's bonds, it can be commodities, it can be rates. But again, the portfolios are systematically, quantitatively built on both the long and the short side. Leverage can be significant, specifically on the systematic macro side, so it's a consideration in assessing managers. But generally, equity beta will be low within these strategies. It's also important to note that these are some of the most liquid strategies out there because of the types of securities that they are transacting in. And you know, these strategies, specifically systematic macro, have high liquidity, perform well, have historically performed well in periods of market stress. So these are strategies that could potentially work in the context of the risk diversifying portfolio. And often fees are a little bit lower on the macro side, generally 1% and 20 instead of the 1.5% or 2% and 20. But on the equity market neutral side, fees are generally in the 1.5% to 2% and 20% of profits. All right, so rounding out the strategies is discretionary macro, which is different than systematic macro in terms of it's more of a human component. Views are taken by portfolio managers and research analysts on rates, FX, bonds, equity, even betting on volatility. But again, this is fundamental research done by a human being who is taking a view on the direction of these commodities. So that differs from the systematic macro where it's more quantitatively driven. These are often thematic. So whether it's a portfolio manager betting on a European recovery or betting on rising rates or a strong dollar, there tends to be some sort of research process that results in themes developing, and then they implement those themes through the selection of securities in order to build the portfolio. Because of this thematic nature and the way that portfolios are built, returns don't generally display a distinct pattern or sensitivity to any one market. So there's a wide range of types of strategies here. And these strategies have also performed well historically in extreme environments. Positive returns in 2008 with high degrees of liquidity as well. So these strategies have not fared as well in recent years. If you'll look down below at the performance chart, given where equity markets have really come in the last 5 years, these strategies will underperform equity markets in bull markets, but where they really shine is in periods of market stress. So they tend to help protect on the downside and will give you slightly positive performance in normal markets. Because of how portfolios are built, there's often heavy use of derivatives. So ensuring that managers have the proper risk controls and they follow their policies and procedures is critical in assessing these types of strategies. And as again, as I noted, I want to make sure it's clear that these are highly liquid strategies, so these do provide benefit in down markets. They're highly liquid. They can be used to buy growth assets after they're sold. So I'll stop there, see if there's any questions on strategy specifics.
I have a question on the lack of transparency concern. Are there some strategies that are better at receiving that transactional information?
Yeah, so it really comes down to the preference of the manager itself. So some managers really have policies that they don't want to be transparent. Other managers are willing to provide daily holdings on a daily basis. So it really is about the manager's policies. And historically, in my research capacity, researching hedge funds, there's managers who don't provide good transparency, and you just don't have to do business with them. You don't really, no one's forcing people to invest in funds, and generally my experience is avoiding managers who don't provide good transparency. And over the years, transparency has increased as investor demand for transparency has increased. So I would say that transparency is not as bad as it used to be, but it's still an issue with some managers.
And then what are some of the things that Verus does to kind of get over that hurdle with some of the better managers that don't have as much transparency?
Get over the hurdle? We don't work with them.
Don't work with them.
General avoidance. Yeah. It depends on the size. If you're willing to make a big enough investment, oftentimes you do have leverage in getting special rights in terms of transparency. But managers do want to avoid giving preferential treatment to certain investors. So some of the well-known managers out there who have billions and billions of dollars who don't need to be providing this transparency and who have long waiting lists often won't budge. But other managers who are hungrier, who are willing to get investors in the door, will often be more flexible with transparency.
And Glenn, if I could just follow up on Gail's comment there. Are we seeing in general, I mean, you're saying it's an individual manager preference, but in general, the activist managers, the merger arbitrage would have more at stake if they disclose their position. The strategies that we're discussing here are more systematic in nature, are higher turnover in nature. If their information is public, it's not as big of a deal to that or impactful to those.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there are strategies where being more secretive is actually part of the process. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the strategies we're really addressing here for your portfolio, that tends to be less of an issue.
When PERS announced some time back that they were getting out of hedge funds, although they were a very small percent of their total holdings, is there any trend on which way funds are now going in terms of hedge funds?
We're having a lot of discussions like this about getting past the name of the hedge funds and understanding what the functional role of the strategy can be and whether that makes sense or not. So I think the CalPERS end of things are some specific issues that they're dealing with from a political side of things that we don't have to contend with. As an industry, I think the fees are under a lot of scrutiny. The equity-like returns with bond-like volatility is blown out of the water, and so that has hurt those investors who believed that they were getting it. And then when you actually look at what they can do, there's a fresh look of saying, hey, these strategies do have merit if you weed through them properly. And so the importance on manager and strategy selection is increased, and when you take that into consideration, they make a lot of sense.
So you're not seeing similar 37 Act plans electing not to pull away from whatever hedge funds they may now be in or not going towards?
No, we're seeing increased demand.
Okay.
And hedge fund industry assets are actually at an all-time high right now. Despite all the headlines, overall hedge funds still manage more assets today than they ever have.
I thought they experienced a decline of assets under management.
So the number of hedge funds has actually come in, so a lot more have closed their doors and new launches have been down. But if you look at the total assets under management, it's actually, it might have had one quarter of a slight dip, but overall, trend, assets are actually.
Yeah, I thought it did in 2016. I thought that was a, that it, Crest.
You may be right. The last thing I read was at an all-time high, but still close.
We have a couple other pages just to wrap this up. The page 29 gets into some other strategies. This is just some background on some of the other strategies we're not necessarily think that would add a lot of value to the portfolio. The key point, I think, is really to jump to page 34, where we get into decision-making criteria. So thinking about the governance process and how we want to implement is as important as what we would want to implement. So there are some considerations here for us in terms of portfolio structure and manager selection. There is the administrative work with paperwork and funding and treasury functions, and then the ongoing oversight and maintenance. So these are more, they require more oversight than our typical managers. Similarly, the underwriting requires both investment due diligence and operational due diligence. A lot of the hedge fund firms get written up for breaking down on the operational side of things. Madoff would certainly be a case of that, but plenty of others run into issues there. And so the operational due diligence is really important. The next couple of slides talk about three different approaches to getting hedge fund exposure in a fund-of-fund structure, which has a low degree of customization. And we think customization is probably pretty important here, given that we're trying to fit something specifically to the growth portfolio, which would lead us to either page 36 or 37, where we look at a fund-of-one structure or a specialty consultant structure. I think this is to be determined. Again, this is just an educational deck, and so we're not making the recommendation one way or another at this point. But similar to when you looked at the private markets space and said there are components out there, various players have various skill sets, some are better than others, how would we want to look at the universe and see what's best for us? Probably a similar exercise to be done here. And the difference being between these two pages, again, is level of discretion. Do you turn the discretion over to the fund of one manager, or do you retain that and hire a specialty consultant to help you work through it? Those are the key trade-offs there. And as you might imagine, the fees are different depending on the arrangement as well.
On your page 37, Ed, you've got under costs, you have the specialty consultant as the most effective cost option. Based on, I guess, the flat fee. We just had a discussion with our prior guests. But I guess what I'm trying to understand is you don't avoid the fund fee exposures, right? The active management fees that are embedded in the strategy, right?
Correct.
So on the prior two strategies where the cost is deemed to be high, that's the additive cost on top of the fee exposure?
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. Just want to make sure I understood the comparison.
Fund of hedge funds will generally charge, on top of whatever the underlying manager fees are, they'll charge an additional 1% management fee plus something like 5 to 10% of profits in addition to what's being charged by the underlying managers.
Got it. Thank you. That's helpful.
So 2 and 20 moves to 3 and 3. Wow. Okay.
Yes, that's why we skipped over that page. And went
to time for you to jump in, John.
Real opportunity here.
Right. No, I mean, that's what we wrestle with. That's what we've been, we and staff have been wrestling with, is that we see strategies that could be effective in the portfolio. How do we get it so that they are actually effective at the end of the day for us? Right. This is part of the challenge. So it has some underwriting work to be done. It has the implementation, the oversight, the fee negotiation, all of that good stuff for it to really come home.
So am I correct that the specialty consultant strategy on page 38, you have the little comparative chart, there the summary of the implementation approaches. Is the specialty consultant sort of door 3 on the right, essentially what we heard with Stepstone?
Similar approach.
Similar, I should say. Not the same, but is that the same basic approach that we're talking about?
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. Just we want to reinvent the wheel, but I just want to make sure I got it right.
And there's different governance models with different specialty consultants where they could potentially bring each manager to the board for approval, or they have some sort of level of delegation of authority. So specialty consultants work in different ways as well, similar to how the world's in private.
Right. You could have cutoff points where they have to bring some kind of decision forward if it's over 100 million or whatever.
Why do they use a Bethany structure?
They're not as smart as the...
Consultants haven't figured out how to charge fees appropriately. The way you engage and the way you engage with the clients on a consultancy basis is we're here at your disposal for anything you need, and therefore it's historically been this is what we think is going to cost for us to provide you with the level of engagement that you need, and that's a fixed cost so that if it ramps up 1 year or ramps down 1 year, it provides that clarity to the client. Obviously, attorneys and actuaries charge by the hour. Consultants tend to charge flat fees. It's the convention.
Well, once
sign me up for the flat fee.
Yeah, I want the flat fee deal too.
And a key differentiator there is that commingled funds and fund of ones have discretion, and so when they have discretion, they take on greater risk in their business, so they need to be compensated for taking on greater risk. And so they tend to say, okay, well, the best alignment then is between the decisions we make for your portfolio and the amount we charge you. That sounds like a performance fee to us. Does that align well with you? And tends to be where the market has found it to work well. Okay, so I think that we're certainly happy to answer any further questions on any of this. Coming out of this, we'd like to incorporate into the models for finalizing the asset allocation at the May meeting. And so if we include this 9% allocation to risk diversifying and we think about it in terms of risk parity and certain hedge fund exposures that we foresee in the future, then we'd want to then start laying the groundwork for, once that allocation is approved, what are the next steps we're going to do to start actually pursuing implementation. So that's the direction we're seeking from the board, or any resistance or pushback on any of that.
Where does this 9% come from?
Where does it come
from? Is it now invested in similar type funds? It isn't, is it?
Yeah, John, this is the entire risk diversifying allocation is 12%, 3% is already on the Treasury side, that's invested. The rest of it is in a placeholder of about 3% allocated right now to the Wellington Real Total Return as a proxy for this space. So we have a placeholder there. We have 6% that's still in the equity markets. It hasn't been allocated on here because we haven't had this conversation yet. So this will be probably repositioning of that Wellington portfolio and then pulling down that equity exposure. You recall we've got a pretty low target public equity exposure, but a pretty high current public equity exposure. That's kind of earmarked for a number of, for the private markets, for this, and that's why we're implementing asset allocation via these resolutions and kind of doing these every 3 to 6 months. Now we're ready to deploy this capital. Right now we need to get the direction from the board. Let's talk about the model. So when the model comes back in terms of a recommendation a month from today, we're going to adopt it. Once we've adopted that, let's talk about implementation, and then we can start to move that money over the course of the summer.
So essentially between the presentation we heard this morning and this, in roughly 2 month time frame, we're dealing with about a third of the portfolio.
Impactful of about a third of the portfolio, yes.
Yeah. Give or take 35%.
So the board's already adopted that top level. This is where we want to get to. Now we're saying, what resources do we need? What information needs to come to the board so we can start to be implementing this?
28 and 9 would be 37.
This is $2.5 billion, but who's counting?
This is where the rubber meets the road.
Any further questions of Glenn or Ed? Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you.